A disgrace to the profession. The world scientists in their own words. On Michael E. Mann, his hockey stick, and their damage to science. Volume 1. Compiled and edited by Mark Stein. Illustrated by Josh. Narrated by Melissa Howes. Published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved. Part 1. Quote, "If these scientists have done something wrong, it will be found out, and their peers will determine it. Don't get your information from me, folks, or any newscaster. Get it from people with Ph.D. after their names." Unquote. Ed Begley Jr., actor and environmental activist, in TV interview with Stuart Varney, November 24, 2009. Nalias Enwerba, motto of the Royal Society, adopted shortly after its founding in November 1660. Introduction by Mark Stein. Climate of Fear. Quote, "Over the last 10,000 years, it has been warmer than today 65% of the time," unquote. Professor Gernot Petzold, Ph.D., the International Climate and Energy Conference, Munich, 2011. Here's Mark. "Once upon a time, there was a thing called, quote-unquote, geologic time. It was a hell of a ride, as Professor Robert Laughlin of Stanford summarizes. Quote, 6 million years ago, the Mediterranean Sea dried up. 90 million years ago, alligators and turtles cavorted in the Arctic. 150 million years ago, the oceans flooded the middle of North America and preserved dinosaur bones. 300 million years ago, Northern Europe burned to a desert and coal formed in Antarctica." Unquote. No humans were involved, nor a single SUV or air conditioner. There was no caveman Al Gore to distribute an awareness-raising poster of the last gator plashing merrily around the North Pole as the ice closes in. Hasta la vista, Arctic turtle. See you later, alligator. Quote, "Climate change is a matter of geologic time, something that the Earth routinely does on its own without asking anyone's permission or explaining itself. The Earth doesn't include the potentially catastrophic effects on civilization in its planning. Were the Earth determined to freeze Canada again, for example, it's difficult to imagine doing anything except selling your real estate in Canada." Unquote. I doubt even Michael E. Mann, the subject of this book, and a man ever ready to pin the scarlet D to your chest, could get away with labeling Robert Laughlin a quote-unquote climate denier. Professor Laughlin is a Nobel laureate. A genuine one, that is, not a fake, self-conferred one like Mann. Professor Laughlin is less a climate denier than a climate insouciant. If God or Gaia decides to reset the global thermostat, you might as well relax, because there's not much you can do about it. Long after a dank Nordic chill settled on sun-drenched Scandinavia, and the American Midwest emerged from underwater, and the polar bears hunted the Yukon alligator to extinction, and the Mediterranean Bedouin on their annual desert trek from Tangiers to Monte Carlo said, "Hey, that oasis seems to be a lot bigger than it was last year." Long after the upheavals of geologic time, man retained a certain humility before the awesome power of nature. And then came the hockey stick. It was the single most influential graph in the history of climate science. It leapt from the pages of a scientific journal to the posters and slides of the transnational summits, to official government pamphlets selling the Kyoto Protocol, to a starring role on the big screen in an Oscar-winning movie, to the classrooms of every schoolhouse throughout the Western world. At the turn of the 21st century, it sold the simplest of propositions. This is the hottest year of the hottest decade of the hottest century of the millennium, which is like forever. And suddenly, no one remembered geologic time or natural climate variability anymore. In the history of man-made climate change, nothing happened in the world before the 20th century, as Oxford physicist Jonathan Jones put it, after which the mercury shot up and straight through the top of the thermometer. In other words, it's all your fault. As MIT's Richard Lindzen observed, quote, this is the problem. These guys think saying climate changes, saying it gets warmer or colder by a few tenths of a degree, should be taken as evidence that the end of the world is coming. And it completely ignores the fact that until this hysteria, climate scientists used to refer to the warm periods in our history as optima, unquote. He says that like it's a good thing. In 2012, Michael E. Mann sued me and various other parties in the District of Columbia Superior Court for, quote-unquote, defamation of a Nobel Prize recipient. He was obliged to withdraw the false claim to be a Nobel Prize recipient, but not the defamation charge, over my description of his hockey stick as, quote-unquote, fraudulent. I'll stand by that. It does not prove what it purports to prove. Whether or not Al Gore and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change knew that, I doubt the schoolchildren to whom it has been force-fed for a generation ever did. I wonder how many of those who regard it as an authoritative graph of global climate across the centuries are aware that its hockey stick shape for the entire hemisphere depends on two clumps of trees, some California bristlecones, and some cedars from the Gaspé Peninsula. Or rather, for the years up to 1420, just one cedar from the Gaspé Peninsula. Quick, hands up! Who knows where the Gaspé Peninsula is? I do, because I'm a Quebecer, and I've been to the Gaspé dozens of times and regard it as one of my favorite places on Earth. But it is not the Earth. How many of us, on being assured that the quote-unquote science is settled, are aware that it's been settled on the basis of one Quebecois tree? 2 years after Mann launched his suit, in one of those procedural sideshows that encrust the sclerotic and dysfunctional U.S. court system like barnacles on the hulk of a rusting tugboat at the bottom of the Suez Canal, came the deadline for third parties to file amicus briefs with the courts. The American Civil Liberties Union, the Washington Post, NBC News, the Los Angeles Times, and various other notorious right-wing climate deniers all filed amici briefs opposed to Michael Mann and his assault on free speech. They did this not because they have any great love for me or any of the other parties, but because their antipathy was outweighed by their appreciation of the First Amendment and an understanding of the damage a Mann victory would inflict on it. On the other hand, ever since this tedious suit was launched by Mann, his supporters had insisted that it's not about free speech at all. Instead, as they see it, it's about science finally fighting back against a sustained assault by Koch-funded deniers. This sub-headline encapsulates the general line. Michael Mann is taking a stand for science. Gotcha. Michael Mann is not doing this for Michael Mann, or even for Michael Mann science, or even for climate science. He's doing it for science. Man is science, and science is man. In court, his argument was a straightforward appeal to authority. Why all these eminent acronymic bodies from the EPA and NSF and NOAA, even unto HMG in London, have proved that all criticisms of Mann are false and without merit. So I certainly expected them to file briefs on his behalf. And given that Mann sees this as part of a broader, quote-unquote, war on science by well-funded deniers, I also expected briefs from the various professional bodies, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Physical Society, the Royal Society, etc. And yet, the deadline came and passed, and not a single amicus brief was filed on behalf of Mann. Not one. So Michael Mann is taking a stand for science, but evidently science is disinclined to take a stand for Michael Mann. The self-appointed captain of the hockey team is playing solo. As Dr. Judith Curry of Georgia Tech wrote, quote, the link between defending Michael Mann is defending climate science seems to have been broken, unquote. Dr. Curry has a point. If you're defending Michael Mann, you're not defending science or defending climate science or theories on global warming or anything else. Defending Michael Mann means defending Michael Mann, and it turns out not many people are willing to go there. Mann had rested his case on an appeal to authority, to what eminent people say about him. I regard appeals to authority as somewhat un-American. But even for those of us born in lands less philosophically committed to egalitarianism, they're a bit whiffy. A cat may look at a king, as they used to say in medieval Europe. So why can't a skeptic kitty look at a climate king? But Mann was taking his appeal to authority to the next level, appealing falsely to authorities. Most of the official reports he claimed exonerated him, quote unquote, had not a word to say about him. The Nobel Institute had nothing to say about him other than that he had never won a Nobel Prize. And now the world scientist he claimed to be taking a stand for had fallen deathly silent. And so I started wondering, what in fact do all these scientists think of Mann and his methods? Initially, I assumed it would just be the usual contrarians, the skeptics, the deniers. But then I discovered that around the world there are many, many scientists who, broadly speaking, believe in anthropogenic global warming, quote unquote, but do not believe in man. We wound up with far more material than we could ever fit in one book. So this is volume one, which I intended to confine to a nice round number of 100 scientists, 10 scientists on 10 aspects of man and his work, but it grew to 12 aspects, and we squeezed in a few more scientists in the introduction to each chapter. We'll try to hold it down to my planned 100 per volume for the second installment. Some of them are distinguished emeritus profs and fellows of the Royal Society, but some are young up-and-comers. Many are from the heart of the Anglo-American climate establishment, but others are from Europe and elsewhere and don't quite understand why a small clique of outliers single-handedly determines the consensus in the field, quote unquote. There are fewer women than one might wish, but it seems to be a male-dominated field, and indeed there is a palpable misogyny in the way some of Mann's defenders attack his female critics. Some are, quote-unquote, climate scientists, an extremely elastic term that has evolved considerably in recent decades, and some practice in related fields, but all know how science is meant to work and how, in Mann's case, it failed to work. Oh, and one other ecumenical point. Mann told an Irish interviewer that, quote, in the U.S., belief in climate change is about as good a predictor of party affiliation as anything in this country, unquote. In other words, only right-wing loons oppose him, but among the scientists you'll hear from in these pages are men of the left. Sometimes the Scandinavian social democrat left, sometimes the hardcore Marxist left. Indeed, Mann's scourge, Stephen McIntyre, the Toronto mining engineer who dismantled the hockey stick, is, I think it's fair to say, a fairly conventional Trudeauian liberal in Canadian terms. Genuine Nobel laureate Ivar Giaver voted for Obama, as did fake Nobel laureate Mann. Oxford University's Jerry Revetz equates ClimateGate with Tony Blair's sexed-up dossier to justify invading Iraq. One of Mann's more dull-witted partisans, Greg Gladden of Science Blogs, noted the presence of Eduardo Zurita and Simon Tett on the list of scientists herein, and assumed I'd made a mistake because these are, quote-unquote, mainstream climate scientists, rather than deniers. But I'm afraid poor Mr. Laden is missing the point. As this book demonstrates, there's no contradiction between being pro-science and thinking man is full of it. For example, Michael Liebrich is a visiting professor at Imperial College London and advisory board chairman of Bloomberg New Energy Finance, whose broad disposition you can deduce from its name. He's also on the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on the New Energy Architecture and the UN Secretary General's Heavy Level Group on Sustainable Energy for All. Get the picture? He believes in global warming, but he doesn't believe in Michael Mann. Invited by a tweeter called Christian Thalacker to, quote, help science heroes like Professor Michael Mann, unquote, Mr. Liebrich replied coolly, quote, Michael Mann, the Michael E. Mann, who withheld data and conspired to exclude competing authors from journals, is no science hero of mine, unquote. Amid the groupthink that is big climate, this was not the response Christian Thaliker expected to receive. He was outraged and tweeted back that he would be taking it up with Liebrich's boss. Quote, FYI, I'm letting Mike Bloomberg know. Identity fraud! Twitter at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. And he did. Quote, at Mike Bloomberg, at Bloomberg LP, Michael Liebrich, NEF chairman, against climate science? Question mark? Unquote. Get that? If you're against Michael Mann, you're against climate science. Mann's view is that le climat, c'est moi. And he means it. Nevertheless, Mr. Liebrich pushed back at the charge that he was, quote-unquote, against climate science. Quote, nope, I'm against abuse of academic power, just as I am against abuse of any power. No exceptions for any cause. Unquote. Nope, I'm against abuse of academic power, just as I am against abuse of any power. No exceptions for any cause. Unquote. Mann himself decided to weigh in at this point and took time off from whining about all the one-star reviews of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars to recommend that Liebrich should read my book. Mr. Liebrich responded, quote, at Michael E. Mann, I've read hashtag HSCW and hashtag ClimateGate emails. I think you were sloppy and unethical. I also think that, quote, AGW is real, unquote. A few more from Liebrich. Conflating climate science with at Michael E. Mann discredits good climate science. Based on his indefensible methods and behavior, he's going down and taking a lot of good scientists with him. The fact other scientists have found warming is profoundly different from them replicating his flawed work. It has never been replicated because you can't without access to original data and algorithms. So it's junk. Unquote. That's the dispute between the scientists in these pages, whether Mann's work is junk science, bad science, pseudoscience, pathological science, or, quote, brazen fraud. But there's not a lot of people willing to defend it as, quote, good climate science, unquote. As Michael Liebrich's Twitter feed suggests, it requires some energy and resilience to push back against Mann from within the global warming establishment. I was struck by that and a little disturbed. On the eve of publication of this book, Esquire ran a long article with a fey headline, Ballad of the Sad Climatologists. This was one of those pieces that now crops up every few months about the way climate scientists are suffering from, quote-unquote, pre-traumatic stress syndrome. Because they know the end of the world is nigh, but nobody listens to them. Or as the even more overwrought subheadline put it, when the end of human civilization is your day job, it can be hard to sleep at night. Oh, get over yourself, you hysterical old queen. It's a grim reflection on American journalism that any self-respecting editor could type that with a straight face. The quote-unquote pre-traumatic stress thing is, aside from anything else, immensely trivializing of those suffering from real post-traumatic stress, from actual IEDs in Fallujah and suicide bombers in Helmand, rather than vague, speculative concerns about sea levels in the Maldives a century hence. Even among scientists, Professor Tony Brown, whom we shall meet later, had the grim task of serving as, quote-unquote, soil analyst for the International Criminal Tribunal investigating war crimes in Bosnia, and surely has more claim to being stressed out by science. Nevertheless, I turned the page, and inevitably there he was. Sad climatologist numero uno, Michael E. Mann, supposedly the target of the most powerful deniers in the world, along with fellow data hoarder and big cheese butterfly ecologist Camille Parmesan, Mann's real climate colleague Gavin Schmidt, and a couple of others to round out the numbers. And not for the first time you wonder, if there's a 97% consensus, why is it always the same handful of names in these pieces, even amidst the somnolent drones of American magazine writing? Does it ever occur to anyone that maybe this time it would be nice to hear from someone other than Mann and the usual suspects? He may indeed be, quote, the target of the most powerful deniers in the world, unquote, the Koch brothers, me, or did we mention the Koch brothers? But his son's scientific science is also the target of Nobel laureates, the president of the Royal Statistical Society, and the man who coined the term global warming. He's also the target of significant numbers of Scandinavian climatologists who think that, instead of regarding the end of human civilization as his day job, man ought to concentrate on his actual day job and learn to handle their raw data with minimal competence. Why do we never hear from them? Why is it always man and a handful of other Ayatollahs of alarmism? Imagine how much more interesting the public discourse might be if the climate conversation expanded beyond the pre-stressed, self-traumatized navel-gazers. Come to think of it, how come they suck all the CO2 out of the room anyway? When you get embroiled in as many time-consuming legal matters as I do, it's always fun to have something bigger at stake than a mere courtroom victory. I find otherwise it's all a bit of a bore. When the Canadian Human Rights Commissions came after me in Maclean's magazine, we turned the tables and put the human rights system itself on trial. The eventual repeal by Parliament of the disgusting and indefensible hate speech law was personally far more satisfying than the not guilty verdict the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal graciously bestowed on me in Maclean's. By that stage, we had way bigger fish to fry. In this case, man is suing me for defamation. I'd like to win that case because losing it would be the worst setback for free speech in America in the half century since New York Times versus Sullivan. But as important a goal for me is lifting the climate of fear that man and his fellow enforcers have imposed on a critical field of science and in the broader sphere of public policy. The ugly retaliation that the climate mullahs use against anyone who steps out of line, as we'll see later in the hockey sticking of distinguished Swedish scientist Lennart Bengtsson, ought to appall any real man of science. You shouldn't have to be a Nobel laureate like Ivar Giaver, or as well-connected as Maibel Liebrich, to be able to speak out without suffering bloody reprisals. So I'd like to end the protection racket of the Clime Syndicate and put them out of the intimidation business. One quick bit of business. In the pages that follow, the source for each scientist quotation is footnoted. However, because of the extraordinary level of paranoia about quote-unquote doctored quotes that attends the climate debate, we've retained the various spellings, British, American, or the often charming English of Swedes and Finns, and made only a few punctuation changes. Each scientist is introduced by a brief recap of his curriculum vitae. As I said above, a cat may look at a king, but the position of Emperor Mike's courtiers is that only a cat with a PhD may gaze upon his tree-ringed majesty. So we've also stuck all those in. As a fellow with not a single letter after my name, I've never typed so many postnominals in my life. That said, what follows would not have been possible without the sterling work of Stephen McIntyre and Ross McKittrick, or without A.W. Montford's invaluable book, The Hockey Stick Illusion. These men did the real peer review that Nature, the CRU, the IPCC, and man's professional colleagues all balked at. Just to recap, these scientists have all manner of views on climate change, CO2, the warming pause, etc. But their words on Michael Mann deserve to be more widely known. The truth about the hockey stick was always obvious to anyone who looked at it coolly and objectively. On Sunday, January 26, 2003, at 10:27 p.m. on a Yahoo discussion forum for climate skeptics, a Dutch doctorandus called Hans Arron posted a short note pointing out a few curiosities in Mann's method. Quote, "Dear Forum, Mann et al. Did the following. They compared North American tree lines and the principal component number one of North American tree rings for the period 1400 to 1980. This was matched. Then they correlated North American tree rings with Northern Hemisphere temperatures 1860 to 1980. How well does Northern Hemisphere temperature correlate with North American temperature? Actually, it doesn't. E.g., for the 48 USA states, the 1930s were comparable to the 1990s. The logical conclusion is that North American trees respond better to global average temperatures than to local temperatures. My big question, why did MBH1999 not use North American temperatures to calibrate North American tree rings data? Then the following jump was made. The ITRDB principal component number one doesn't show a medieval warm period. Therefore, the average northern hemisphere average globe, must not show an AMWP. And the hockey stick was born. Hans E. Unquote. And so it began.